welcome again to another episode of Sacktown Talks. Today, we're glad to be joined by Chris McKaylee, lobbyist, attorney, author, and professor. Chris, how's it going? Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Well, I think as some of my colleagues have often said, no one grows up and says, I want to be a lobbyist. I mean, I didn't even really know what one was until, you know, college at the very least. But in law school, I had clerked for a law firm that on one side did political and election law, and on the other side, government law and lobbying. But they really pushed me towards the political and election law side. So I thought maybe that's where I would be able to combine my love of politics and love of the law. But after a short time, I realized this was not quite what I wanted to do. I felt kind of a glorified accountant.
Right.
Not to insult my friends at the big four accounting firms or anywhere else, but, you know, honestly, most of the work was sort of advising clients like what forms to disclose contributions on, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And so then I thought, well, maybe I'll try to figure out the lobbying thing, because I sort of admired from afar what, you know, that side of the law firm was doing. And at that time, you know, everything was not totally online. There wasn't a Capital Morning report and all those types of things. So I knew only two or three lobbyists, and they suggested that I apply to a trade association because a trade association would be a great training ground. And so right here in this building in the Senator Hotel was then the California Manufacturers Association. We used to say the other CMA as opposed to the medical, because this was before they added end technology.
Right.
That's how long ago it was, unfortunately. And they were looking for a tax lobbyist. And at that time, thankfully, McGeorge actually required their graduates to take at least one tax course on federal tax law and some other stuff. And I had actually had an interest in it, believe it or not. I even did the VITA program, Voluntary Income Tax Assistance, where you helped individuals, you know, in the Oak Park area prepare their tax returns and everything else. Yeah. So the woman who was the VP at CMA then was Ann Kelly. She was the former policy director for Willie Brown when he was speaker for a couple of years. And then her last job in the Capitol was chief of staff to Barry Keane. And she took a chance on a young kid, you know, relatively fresh out of law school, and put me to work. And at that time, they had a big tax bill. The president was Bill Campbell, a retired state senator from Orange County. And one of his best friends was the assembly speaker, Willie Brown. And he got Brown to author this tax bill for the manufacturers. And so we saw it through, it got signed into law that year. And so it was a great opportunity. And just, I fell in love with the process and everything else. And after a couple of years, I got recruited by a firm that was also in this building, Carpenter Snodgrass and Associates. Denny Carpenter was ironically a former Republican state senator from Orange County, like Bill Campbell was. And then one of the first female named partners of a lobbying firm, Kathy Snodgrass, she had been legal counsel to Willie Brown for 3 years before she became a lobbyist. And she and Denny partnered up a few years before I joined. And so I was an associate for a number of years, and then Denny retired, and Kathy and I became partners for a short time, and unfortunately cancer took her life. And then I joined California Strategies, the firm that Bob White had formed, and opened their lobbying wing, and did that for a couple of years, and then went into another firm, and Mark Aprea and I joined forces, and so it's been the two of us for the last 15 years.
Okay, so you and Mark have only been together for 15 years.
Only 15.
Only. It seems longer, but I guess in reality, 15 years is a long time.
It is. I jokingly say I started off with Ann always calling me the kid. Mm-hmm. You know, she'd say, you're as young as my son.
Right.
And now my wife read a piece where the quote was attributed to veteran lobbyist Chris McKaylee, mm-hmm. and she turned and said, you know, that means you're old.
So, always keeping you humble, huh?
Exactly, yes, yes. Wow. My family definitely does that, yes.
And so kind of when I first got into this 10 years ago, one of the things I found fascinating is, you know, every lobbyist has a different style. And, you know, you have a different style as you're known for always being in the building, front and center. Kind of, how did you develop your style, and kind of why do you feel it's necessary to be kind of in front of the action all the time?
Well, I really, you know, I was a political science public service major at UC Davis. And really, I love the institution and I love the process and am fascinated. And I think from that poli-sci background, I love the big ticket, you know, issues and the debates and, you know, being a part of that, I think, is one of the most pleasurable parts of being a lobbyist. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really want to, you know, tool around in little things. I like to, you know, I've been fortunate over the years, either with a trade association or clients, to be heavily involved in a lot of the big issues before the legislature. And I think that's one of the most interesting and certainly challenging, you know, aspects of being a lobbyist. But that's what I really enjoy doing.
Yeah. So like the past, 2 years, we've had COVID-19.
Yeah.
It's been kind of tough for a lot of people to lobby. How have you kind of been navigating kind of lobbying with COVID and all these restrictions?
Yeah, I mean, look, in the beginning, it was problematic, but, you know, you had established relationships with legislators and staff, and all of a sudden, instead of seeing them in person, you were talking to them on the phone or by Zoom, which was definitely a unique experience. But, you know, you felt like, okay, you know, I don't always see these people in person. Sometimes I pick up the phone. We all email each other and things like that. So we've communicated in different forms. But certainly when the new crop of legislators came in, you know, after the 2020 election, that was more unique, trying to get to know and establish a relationship with these newly elected members and certainly a lot of new staff when you didn't have any in-person connection with them yet. Mm-hmm. So that definitely proved more challenging. So it's been nice, particularly in the last few months, to have greater personal interaction with folks, which is really the way a lot of business gets done. And, you know, just running into fellow lobbyists and legislators and staff just on the street, or, you know, walking in and out of the new swing space, you almost forget how much business we often transacted, not in the formal appointment, but in those, you know, personal interactions that you just happen to run into somebody. You know, in the old days, it was sort of in and out of the Capitol, or maybe waiting in line at the sixth floor cafeteria, you know, and you said, darn, I needed to see, you know, so-and-so's chief or their ledge director, and I just ran into him here, so I can scratch that one off, that I don't have to go to their office. And so that was certainly challenging. I think the other thing was, is, you know, when you can make your way around the building, you can see a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. When everything was remote, you know, sometimes it would take 2 or 3 days to connect. Okay, when does a Zoom work for you? Oh, next Tuesday. And then you wait 5 days or a week before you could have dropped in. And even if they said, oh, so-and-so's on the phone or they're with the boss in committee, why don't you come back in an hour? Boom, you could get, you know, a dozen meetings done during the day. Right. Now it might take you 2 or 3 to set up the Zoom, wait another 3 or 5 days to do the Zoom. And, you know, so it definitely delayed our ability to connect a lot of times.
Sure. How are you finding the new swing space kind of to adapt to being, you know, I guess, convenience-wise, you know, seeing members and kind of seeing some of that same collaboration you just kind of talked about in the old kind of annex?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things. First of all, it's a longer walk. Mm-hmm. I used to have a lovely 4 or 5 minute walk from my building at 1415L through the park and up and out into or out of the east steps of the Capitol, you know, on the park side. Now, obviously, we have to cross over the park and go not only down 11th, but halfway down O Street before we can even enter the building. So definitely there's a distance issue. Right. But, you know, I love the swing space. I know that there are some members and staff who are unhappy, certainly those who have long enjoyed, you know, an office with a door. Now there's only 2, right, for the member and the chief. And certainly some offices are smaller. But then again, a lot of folks didn't have windows to the outside world. Now everyone right. does. But, you know, for lobbyists and members of the public, obviously, on almost every space, there is meeting space, there are chairs, there's work areas, they've got plug-ins. Right. I mean, even the fancy chairs on the first floor and second floor hearing rooms, about every second or third, they've got plug-ins in those little couch sitting areas. You know, so that's really a great change. And I know that the new annex, once it's built in 4 or 5 years, will have all of those modern amenities, you know. So that's pretty nice. But you'll recall in the old annex, we either had the sixth floor cafeteria
right.
or the basement cafeteria. That was it. Mm-hmm. Now every floor has some meeting or workspace. Oh, so it's nice. Really nice. Yeah.
You know, we've had like, 28, close to 30 members announced. They're not going to, you know. They're not coming back.
Crazy.
They're not going to run again.
Yeah.
You know, everyone has different reasons. But kind of, what's your take on this? Why do you think you're seeing so much turnover here for these 12-year members, really?
Well, I think between, you know, it's the end of the road, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the 12 years is a lifetime. And obviously, with the first crop coming in 2012, 2024 would be the time for them to depart. So folks were either looking for, you know, once a decade congressional or maybe local, or certainly some of them have done private sector jobs now. But I think that coupled with, of course, reapportionment caused a number of folks where one was going to run against a colleague. Did they really want to do that? Did it make sense to run against somebody, for example, who had 2 or 3 or 4 terms ahead of them while you only had one final 2-year term?
Right.
So it's a multitude of factors. It's not one single thing. But, you know, when they all came in 2012, we thought, okay, in 2024, we're going to have a turnover of about 30, 34 people.
Right.
And so we knew that that was coming. But as we saw, I mean, we have what, 8 or 9, like fewer than 10 of that original 2012 class who are actually going to finish out their 12-year terms,
right.
Assuming that they all get reelected, of course, this November. But so more than 2/3 of that first 12-year class will not see out their entire 12 years.
That's crazy.
Which is crazy. Yeah, I was just going to use the same phrase. Yes.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild and definitely not what we had expected.
Right. Everyone expected 12 years.
Absolute continuity that they would stay there. You know, we have some members in their first or second term who are headed to the Senate or maybe to a congressional seat or whatever else. So, yeah. But, I mean, we have seen greater stability, you know, those early years of of term limits obviously resulted in a maximum 3 2-year terms in the assembly, which everyone agreed was a joke.
Right.
You were lucky if somebody made it over to the Senate because then they had another 8 and, you know, 14 years isn't bad. Mm-hmm. I still would prefer a little longer, but it is what it is. It's
right.
better than the prior version, let's put it that way.
Exactly.
Even though they reduced from 14 to 12, at least some stability with 12 right. in one house is better. Yeah.
You're considered, I guess, one of the kind of the policy experts on tax law areas. Kind of, how did you establish that? You know, you kind of touched on your McGeorge stuff and kind of, you know, establish yourself as one of the, you know, tax experts on policy here at the Capitol.
Well, I developed a little bit of an interest, not that I was going to practice tax law by right. any means, you know, let's get that out there. But, I mean, you know, had an interest. And as I said, the main job that I was hired for in that first lobbying gig for the manufacturers was to do their tax mm-hmm. work. Because I was an attorney, Ann actually said, you know, we'd like to restart what they called their corporate counsel committee, basically those out of the legal departments of manufacturing companies, you know, the general counsel office. And so I took that on, and eventually I actually did their in-house legal work. But the main thing was on the tax front. And as I mentioned earlier, that very first year I was there, we did a huge tax bill. Originally, CMA was the sponsor of a sales tax exemption for manufacturing equipment, which was, ironically, even today, 25 years later, it's still an issue of, because we don't offer a full sales tax exemption for all types of equipment. And so there have been efforts on and off to expand it and increase the amount of that exemption. But anyways, you know, a lot of those policy rationales still exist today. But that Speaker Brown at the time actually put that in with a whole bunch of other bills that were authored by some of his members. There was an incentive for the space work down in Santa Barbara to get launches out of there. I remember John Vasconcellos had one for stock ownership of small businesses, and they had a number of other provisions, and basically Speaker Brown put it into a Senate bill and shipped it back over to the Senate, and so there was a big battle as to whether or not the Senate would take it up. But as a result of that first year, so that was probably the highest profile tax bill for that year. In fact, a dear friend of mine who is the lobbyist at the Cal Chamber, he's since retired from lobbying, Fred Main, he said that was the biggest tax bill I've been involved with, and he had already been a lobbyist for 15 years or so. As a result of that, there were big regulation projects at both the Franchise Tax Board and the Board of Equalization, so got hot and heavy into that, and then continued in that area. And then when I went into contract lobbying, honestly, my first handful of clients were all in the tax field.
Right.
And so have always, been involved in a lot of those issues, and it's, it comes easy to me. I like the subject matter, and so I've always, sort of played in that sandbox, for lack of a better description.
It's, the best of my memory, you know, the word tax was extremely controversial from 1990 to 2007. And then things changed. We got rid of the two-thirds majority.
For the budget. Prop 25,
right?
Yeah.
But we have the supermajority of Democrats. And one of the fears was, we're going to have tax increases left and right because you need a two-thirds vote for any tax increase.
Of course.
But I can't really recall one recently that's
well,
been
controversial. Well, we had SB1, the gas tax, that resulted in Josh Newman losing his seat in the Senate. Of course, he came back and won it a year and a half later. But no, I think that there was definite fear even in the business community. Mm-hmm. But clearly, while we have a very strong progressive wing of the Democratic caucus in both the Assembly and Senate, there's still quite a few, mod Dems who are concerned about it and fearful of what a, tax increase vote would do to their political careers and all. And so, and obviously with the economy booming and, the state coffers are overflowing, I mean, how many times are we talking now about the GAN limit? So we've got so much money, do we really need any tax increases at this point? So you couple that with a reluctance from a lot of moderate Dems to vote for tax increases. Yes, it really hasn't come to fruition so far.
Well, I guess that was kind of like ever since we've had that tax increase that Jerry Brown put in, what was that, 2008 or 2009 with the voters?
On the sales tax increase and the personal income tax.
Yeah, we haven't seen a budget deficit since.
No, that's true. Now, obviously, the sales tax increase came off, but, labor went to the voters and asked for another extension on the higher rate. And, those are always the easiest ones to pass because, it's the old comment about don't tax me, tax the guy under the tree, right? It's a lot easier. I mean, none of us fall in that, million-dollar bracket, so it's a lot easier to say, sure, I'll vote for that. Let somebody else face the burden. Yeah.
And it seems like these surpluses are growing and growing every year. It's nuts.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I remember when the state budget was, in the 60, 70, 80 billion dollar range, and now we're at 250. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah. So I guess, for those people who don't really understand the GAN limit, what is it and how does it take effect and kind of, what should we expect coming out of this budget, kind of hearing about this GAN limit and this big surplus?
So in 1978, Howard Jarvis and Paul GAN backed Prop 13 to cap property taxes on both residential and commercial industrial property in the state. And the following year, the GAN limit to add what is now Article 13B in the state constitution, basically to cap the amount of spending based upon changes primarily in population and the cost of living in the state. And it's a cap on both, state and local spending, the idea being that, hey, we don't want the proponents of this, obviously, we didn't want to see too much growth every year in the state. And so the GAN limit, actually, you look at two successive fiscal years. And so it's not just a one-shot deal. It requires that growth in excess of that threshold 2 years in a row. And then what it says is, hey, if we go over that, whatever amount we go over, half of it goes to education and half of it goes to a tax rebate. However, it created a number of exceptions. And then in, I think it was 1990 or so, we did Prop 108, 111 related to the gas tax. And we also basically created more ceiling or wiggle room in that base. And it's only in recent years that it's become a problem. And so what the legislature faces is that if we don't find ways of spending some of that excess, then they have to give it back. Now, obviously, education through Prop 98 already gets about 45 cents of every new dollar that comes in. So they're getting quite a bit. But, you know, last year when they dealt with this issue, we had the $600 Golden State share.
Right.
For anyone making less than $75,000 in adjusted gross income, they got that $600 check. That was a way of reducing spending to keep us below the GAN limit. Ah. And so, I mean, last year, there's also an exception for capital outlays. Last year, you may have read that the governor proposed and the legislature approved $1.1 billion to clean up the highways. Mm-hmm. Not the traditional definition of capital outlay, but that's how we characterized right. it. And so, you know, we reduced spending. But the money's coming in so fast right now that, you know, they may not be able to get below the GAN limit and actually have to, you know, comply with it. I mean, right now, I haven't seen a recent update, but we're looking at least $25, $30 billion in the current fiscal year that ends June 30th. So they did a little spending in some of the early action items. You know, the idea of this like gas tax rebate or inflation credit, whatever terminology legislators or others want to use, trying to give some of that money back in a more targeted fashion. Because otherwise, in theory, everyone would get a check of X amount, I don't know, $150 or something.
Right.
But if they target it in different ways to keep below that limit, that's what you're beginning to see. So,
you've always been known for kind of keeping tabs on the amount of bills that are kind of moving through the House.
Yeah.
And past 2 years, we've seen a significant drop off. Kind of, what are you seeing this year in kind of volume of bills, and what are you expecting this year?
We're right about the same. So in the first, so remember in 2020, it was March 16th, right? That the legislature shut down. So they had already passed the bill introduction deadline. So we were still normal,
right?
Before they shut down. So we had a full load. Now, obviously, between taking 9 weeks out, I wouldn't say off because obviously they were working remotely, but ultimately in the 2020 session, the legislature reduced by 76%. So three out of every four bills that was introduced, gone, completely gone. So if you look at, you know, the historical records for decades of, you know, all the gubernatorial actions, then all of a sudden you hit 2020 and there's, you know, like 400 new laws instead of 800, 1,000, 1,500 in some years, et cetera, right? So obviously it was a huge drop off. In 2021, it was definitely several hundred bills fewer, but a lot closer to normal than 2020 was. A staffer described to me the 2021 session, which was the legislature tried to be as normal as possible working remotely.
Right.
This year, we're almost back to normal. There were 2,020 introductions. We always see fewer in the second year, which we're obviously in. So usually the low is 1,900, the high is 2,300 in a second year over the last decade plus. So at 2,000, you know, above the low, but not quite the right in between.
Right.
And we're close.
And I guess since you've been tracking this, have you noticed that the bill numbers are increasing? Or I guess the number of bills signed into law, are you seeing that slowly trick up over a year? Is it pretty steady?
No, it's been, again, 2020 was an anomaly, so we have to get rid of that. Governor Brown was on average about 15%. Governor Newsom's first year in office, 15%. Now last year, sorry, it was his veto rate, sorry. In 2021, it was half. It was 8% roughly. I think it was 7.9, but it was 8%. And I actually asked his co-chief of staff about that. And he actually attributed it to the now just departing legislative secretary, Angie Wei, and said that she and her team did a lot better job than in the past, perhaps, of negotiating bills before they got down. And so the need to veto a higher level wasn't necessary. So that was their view of it. But clearly the number went down. Historically, I always use these numbers, not 100%, but rough estimations. The legislature between the two houses introduces between 2,200 and 2,400 bills. About 1,000 get down and about 850 or so get signed. Rough numbers. Obviously, there are slight variances. But so we're seeing, you know, again, 800 to 900 bills, new laws enacted every year. I always joke that that Governor Brown in his first year, I don't know if you recall this statement, but he said in his first year after signing 700 new laws, he says, I don't think there's 700 good ideas that need a law. But of course, when he went out, you know, 7 years later or so, he had signed over 800 bills that year. So,
I was going back and looking at old veto messages from some things, and I noticed when Schwarzenegger was governor, I guess he went through this phase where he just basically was like, I am going to veto a lot of bills. Unless it's like really needed, I'm going to veto it. Did that reflect in his ultimate numbers? Was he still in the 800, 850?
No, definitely fewer. He had I don't recall the exact signed bills, but the veto rates was in the 30%. Yeah, no, he has the highest by far. Well, remember there was that 1 year in his first term where he said, if you don't, you know, send me the budget, I'm going to veto a bunch of bills. And they did their normal thing, which was send them down in the summer before the 30-day period starts. And he vetoed a lot. Right. But no, I mean, I think that Governor Schwarzenegger, for good or for bad, thought that there were too many laws and that there were a lot of bad ideas coming out of a Democrat-controlled legislature. So honestly, he sort of, you know, prided himself, I think, on getting a high veto rate, which is funny because previously, you know, it was the Iron Duke. I wasn't around then, but when George Duke Magian was governor, a high veto rate, but Schwarzenegger, you know, set new records.
Yeah, there's always talk about when a governor vetoes something and, you know, the legislature can, you know, have a two-thirds vote and kind of override that veto. Yeah. Have you ever seen that?
No, I mean, the last time was before I started lobbying by far, you know, in the first years of Jerry Brown. 1979, I think, was the last recorded veto. No, I mean, I think that, well, look, you had a divided government, after Brown, a succession of Republican governors to a generally Democrat-controlled legislature, although in the mid-90s, there was the 1 year or year and a half where Republicans controlled the state assembly, but Democrats never controlled two-thirds, so there was never a real threat. I just remember one time towards the tail end of the Wilson administration, I was on the third floor on the Senate side, and his leg secretary and some other senior staff came up because apparently some Republicans were threatening to join Democrats in a veto override. And his staff prevailed upon them about, you know, essentially saying it would weaken the governor and that wasn't the way to go and we could negotiate something. So that was the last time. I mean, clearly Democrats have been unhappy with both Governor Brown and even now with Governor Newsom on some of his vetoes. And even this year, they kept a whole bunch of veto messages on the daily file, but ultimately they were all struck and no one ever took them up. There's always some rumblings and the press likes to say, well, wait a minute, that bill passed with more than two-thirds, or I think Governor Newsom this past year vetoed a bill or two with near unanimous votes.
Right.
And, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, I think Governor Brown often talked about comity, you know, C-O-M-I-T-Y between the houses, and said, you know, there are reasons on both sides where we just let those things go and the legislature doesn't take up a veto override and I don't gratuitously veto things. Right. And hopefully it leads to negotiation and a compromise in the end.
So now you've kind of taken a shift a couple years ago, right? You started teaching at McGeorge. How's that going?
Well, I love it. Yeah, I was recruited to teach in their capital lawyering concentration, which is part of their JD program. And, you know, I love it. My mom was a school teacher all of her life, teaching art and Spanish from, you know, kindergarten and early grammar school through high school. And my dad, although a chemical engineer by training, he used to do math tutoring for years and even taught at the college level. And, you know, I've been coach of kids' soccer teams and basketball with my girls and my son. And there's always been a part of me that's wanted to, you know, work with students. And so when the opportunity arose, I thought briefly, well, this isn't quite the time that I want to do it. Maybe when my kids are, you know, out of the house and that sort of thing. And then I thought, and in talking with my wife about it, that, well, maybe when I'm ready, my alma mater would not be ready or not have anything available. So I jumped in. You know, it's demanding in the fall, which obviously is a slower time for lobbyists. So it sort of works out. But yeah, I mean, I enjoy it. And now, after I just completed my 7th year at McGeorge.
And 7 years, wow.
7 years. And now, you know, some of my former students are colleagues in the lobbying corps. They're in it, you know, in the executive branch agencies. They're certainly around the legislature. So that's kind of cool to see former students now, you know, working in and around the Capitol. So it's a lot of fun.
I don't know if you thought this, but I thought this when I was in law school.
Yeah.
You know, your professors have different teaching styles.
Of course.
A lot of them have this kind of old school Socratic method style,
yes,
which a lot of students don't like. Kind of what's your teaching style and how did you decide to teach your law class?
Well, we do two things. We have some, yes, look, I'm not much of a lecturer. I like to, you know, pose questions to students. I don't do it in a harsh Socratic way.
Right.
But the interaction, I think, is more valuable. Look, it makes it more interesting for me rather than just, you know, reading a lecture or something like that, I think is terrible. We also use guests in our class. You know, like when we talk about the budget, Chris Woods, who is the Pro Tem's budget director. Before that, he was the Speaker's budget director. And of course, before that, when I knew him, he was chief consultant for the Assembly Budget Committee. You know, he comes over and talks with the students. I mean, why wouldn't we do that? Sure, I've got lots of experience. I've lobbied lots of budget issues. But my goodness, when we've got the guy who has advised the two leaders and run a budget committee who will come over to speak to our students, you know, why not utilize that? And so, you know, we really benefit by being right here in the state capitol and being able to tap into folks like that. So yeah, I do a lot of Q&A with the students based upon their readings. And, you know, I just think it's a better way to share, more interactive. And I think it helps them develop some of the analytical and advocacy skills. I mean, I often say, like on the exams, I'm less concerned with your answer than how you explain or justify it. In other words, some of our exam questions are, you know, what's a procedural hurdle in the legislative process that a legislator or even a lobbyist has to worry about? Right. Well, you could come up with five things and I could. There's not a right or a wrong answer, right? So it's all about whatever you pick, fine by me. How do you explain it? Why? How do you justify that that is the biggest procedural hurdle, for example, that a legislator needs to worry about in getting his or her bill down to the governor's desk?
Yeah. So do you have to grade on a curve? Do you have to like fail some kids? Or are you giving leeway?
No, we don't have to fail them, but there's definitely a curve, which has been interesting. You know, I can appreciate how some full-time faculty members have concerns about that. I enjoy to some degree, you know, reviewing the exams. And we also have in our lawmaking class the two big papers, in addition to their exams, are we actually have them draft a bill and a set of amendments to that bill. And then we have them draft a committee analysis. And the idea is that, you know, what better way to understand and experience and appreciate the lawmaking process than to do that? But as you're familiar with, you know, one of the biggest complaints of law student or law graduate employers is lack of practical experience. So at least in our little, you know, one single class in the JD program is we're trying to give them some practical experience. Right. And it's not everyone who obviously graduates from college or law school that has, you know, drafted a bill in full and written a committee analysis. I mean, normally it's, you know, a legislative council deputy who drafts bills, and it's normally just a committee consultant who gets to analyze a bill.
Right.
But students in our lawmaking class get to do both of those.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So, was it about a year and a half, a year ago, you actually wrote a book? Was this book for your class, or is it just more of a book for people interested in the subject?
Yeah, well, the first, so over the years, probably the last 10 years or so, I've written a series of articles, probably much more in the last couple of years than in the beginning, but I wrote mainly on two subjects. One is on lobbying, and then one is on the legislative process. Again, I think I said at the outset, I love the institution, I love the process, I find it fascinating, challenging, interesting. And so whether it was Capital Weekly, California Globe Today, Cal Matters, and other places, and I've even written a few law review articles for the UOP McGeorge Law Review on some topics, probably more esoteric than the average person cares to know. But a good friend of mine, the former vice president at Cal Chamber, Jeannie Kane, one day she said, you know, you should really put these together into a book. And I said, the thoughts crossed my mind, but I'm not sure. So eventually I worked on the it's called Understanding the Legislative Process. And so that was the first in that area. And then actually the first book that got published was one that I did with about 40 colleagues on lobbying in California. And how that came about, my good friend Ray LeBove has been teaching for more than a decade his Lobbying 101 and 201 seminars.
I'm a graduate.
There you go. Well, he asked me in 2015 or so, again, another 6 or 7 years ago, about this time I started at McGeorge, to teach the regulatory advocacy that's part of the 201 program. So one day after one of the seminars, I said, by the way, do you have any good lobbying books? And so at the next seminar, a couple months later, he gave me probably 5 or 6 of them. And a few of them were pretty good. They were all at the federal level.
Right.
And I said, Ray, you've got a bunch of materials from your lobbying seminars. And, you know, I've written a series of articles about different aspects of the lobbying process. Have you ever found anything on California? And he said, no, there isn't anything there. And I said, well, would you be interested in writing a book? And he said, oh, I've always thought about it, but it's a big undertaking. And I said, yeah, well, let's sit down and come up with, you know, the topics. So over a number of weeks, we developed, you know, probably 50 odd chapters that we thought, just by name, of course, you know, that we thought, yeah, a good lobbying book on California should cover this, that, and the other thing. And we tried to make it from soup to nuts. I mean, literally, like, the lobbying laws, to starting a lobbying firm, to like specialized lobbying, like at the CTC or PUC, and a bunch of stuff in between. And then we started divvying them up. Okay, you write on this and I'll write on that. And then then it came to me and I thought, this is a lot of work. And so I approached Ray again and I said, what would you think about getting maybe some of our colleagues to join us? And he said, oh, that's a great idea. And so we started trying to figure out some folks who would be good at, you know, writing different chapters. And so, for example, the chapter on running a successful lobbying firm, we got Aaron Reed, who's owned his own firm for over 40 years.
Right.
He knows a little something about running a successful firm.
Yeah. That's
anyway, so we.
Cool. Yeah. Everyone has.
Now, that one's a little separate.
Oh, this is a different
one. Yeah,
there's
a different one. So that's ultimately how we got that book. So fast forward a couple of years to the new one, the Lobbying Essays, I call it. It's the Perspectives on State Lobbying, and just came out in the ebook format and hopefully will be in the print edition in the coming weeks. Anyways, my thought was, is I always wondered, you know, some of my colleagues in this field have some great stories about how they get here, what are their experiences, and I think most importantly, like, what sort of knowledge or advice can they pass on to the next generation and people who are either interested in the profession or starting off. There are some great people, including some of the folks who recruited me, you know, Danny Carpenter, Kathy Snodgrass have since passed, some wonderful lobbyists that I've worked with over the years. And I thought, God, I need to get some of these stories before anything else happens. And so I started looking at folks who had been around for, you know, quite a while and tried to put together a list. Now, I'll be honest with you, there are some who said, oh, maybe when I retire, I'll do it, or others were too busy. Others who had retired said, nope, I'm done, you know. So I have certainly more who are still practicing, but I definitely have a handful who are retired and asked them to write essays and sort of focus on, hey, tell us how you got here. You know, some of your, you know, best remembered experiences or bills or issues that you worked on, and then, you know, some advice. And, you know, some folks took it very literally and said, you know, here's my advice, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and others, you know, intertwined that with some of their stories and stuff. And so got, you know, close to 50 colleagues to put together these essays. Maybe down the road there'll be a second volume, because I think there's a lot of other people out there who could
benefit. Yeah, people might pay you to be the next one.
Yeah, exactly. And so again, I just thought this was something, you know, there's nothing else out there. And these people have, you know, great stories to tell about the issues and the bills they've been involved with. And again, to share that knowledge and their advice to people who are starting off or who might be interested in it.
Right.
So that's the goal of the book.
Who had the longest essay of?
Fred Torr. Yeah, retired. I tried to get, look, there are a few who are shorter and a few longer, but most of them are roughly the same. There was no magical. I mean, of course, every time I asked somebody and they said, okay, I'll do it, what's my word count?
Right, yeah.
And I said, just target around this number of pages. But yeah, when Fred submitted his, he said, I went a little over. I said, that's not a problem at all. So whether you were short or long didn't matter. It was, you know, and everything is really their voice. Yeah, I made a few edits here and there, but there's no cookie cutter approach.
Right.
And so it's everybody's voice. Mm. Whether it's, you know, Fred or, you know, anyone else who have written those. Again, some retired, most of them are still active lobbyists. It's them who are speaking and, you know, describing their experiences and how they got here and, you know, again, what advice they would impart to future lobbyists.
Yeah, definitely great. You know, 49 different, you know, stories and backgrounds of, you know, a lot of people we all know. So
I like to say there are 50. But in one chapter, Josh and Donna Penne wrote together.
Okay.
But they did separate, but they wrote them together.
Right.
So we have 50 authors, but 49 chapters.
Okay. And I guess for the listeners who want to check this out, kind of where can they find it? What's it?
Kendall Hunt Publishing Company out of Iowa. Mm-hmm. They've done most of my books. And so they've got it on their website. If you type in lobbying essays or my name, it'll pull up all the books, and this one is here. And again, there'll be a print edition in the coming weeks, but right now it's available. All the other books also have a print one, but this one's
no Amazon yet.
Not on this one. The other books are all available on Amazon.
Okay.
Yes.
And then your other book is the one about, you know, kind of the in-depth of
understanding the legislative process.
Right.
Yeah, and there are a couple other ones. I've done my first set of case books, which was quite an undertaking, but interesting. One on the legislature and the legislative process, the other one on direct democracy.
Is you know, being an author as profitable as one would think?
No, not at all. Well, first of all, this new book on the lobbying essays and the very first book, the lobbyist book, we actually donate any of the proceeds to the Capital Fellows program.
Okay, that's great.
So no one's making any money.
No.
These are not bestsellers by any means,
not yet.
Well, look, the only driving force in it was the fact that there really isn't anything out there, which is still surprising to me in the 2020s,
right.
You know, that there aren't more California specific, you know, the largest state in the nation, the fifth largest economy, blah, blah, blah. Like, how is there not already something on lobbying in California or the California legislative process? We have stuff coming out of our ears at the federal level, but nothing here. So that's really the reason why I did it. So no, the two lobbying books, again, the Tim Hodgson Memorial Fund that's part of the Capital Fellows program is the recipient of the few dollars that are made off of the books. Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking the time and coming to tell
thanks
us about yourself
me,
and your books.
Yeah.
And I guess if any of our listeners want to look you up and find some more information about you, what's the best way to do that?
I guess Google.
Google Michele DePrea.
There you go.
No social media, no Twitter.
Oh,
no
yes.
Facebook.
No, I have. No, the only social media, I guess, is Twitter. But I don't do enough on it.
Right.
You know, I can barely keep up with emails and... You know, for personal things, I try to do Instagram and Facebook every once in a while, some, I guess, work or professional activities on it. But yeah, there's so many things out there.
Right.
No TikToks by me.
That's what we need. All right. Thank you so much, Chris. Good job.
Thank you.
Right there.
Yeah.